Quite suddenly, he felt the ground tilt upwards under his feet sharply. He lost his footing again, but in the same movement rolled to his feet and stumbled over a lip onto level ground where there was the sudden sugary crunch of gravel under his feet. Three stumbling paces, and he came down heavily, his feet knocked out from under him, and as he went down, steel smeared the skin from his outflung forearm. He lay panting and blinded for long seconds, and heard the hunters bay like hounds down the slope. The sound goaded him, and he groped with outstretched hands for purchase to push himself onto his feet once more. He found the cold, smooth steel that had tripped him. It trembled like a living thing under his hands. It came to him then that he had climbed the embankment of the railway line and fallen across the rails of the permanent way. He pushed himself to his knees, and now he heard the deep panting rush in the night. Suddenly the whole slope of the escarpment was lit by reflected light that swung dramatically and brightened like daylight as the locomotive he had heard leaving the goods yard in the valley came roaring out of the deep cutting that skirted the steepest part of the escarpment before crossing the deep gorge of the river. The long white beam of the lamp struck him like a solid thing, and he flung up his arms to shield his eyes and rolled off the rails, crouching down on the gravel on the opposite side to that of his pursuers. In the light of the locomotive lamp, Mark saw a stocky, agile figure coming up the embankment at a run. He ducked across the tracks, directly under the roaring, throbbing loco. The dazzle of light prevented Mark seeing his face, yet there was something familiar in the way the man moved and held his shoulders. The engine came thundering down on Mark, and as it drew level, a spurt of steam from the driving pistons scalded him with its hot breath. Then it was past, and there was just the dark, blurred rush of the boxcars above him. Mark dragged himself upright, balancing on his good foot, and struck the streams of sweat from his eyes, peering upwards to judge his moment. When it came, he almost missed it. His hands were slippery with sweat, and the railing was almost jerked from his grip, even though the train had lost much of its speed and power on the slope. The strain in his shoulder shot an arrow of pain along his arm, and he was torn off his feet, swinging against the side of the boxcar, while he grappled wildly for a grip with his other hand. He found purchase and clung on to the side of the boxcar, his feet still free, but scrabbling for the footplates. And at that moment, hands like steel claws seized his injured ankle. The full weight of a heavy body bore him down, racking him out against the side of the car. Mark screamed with the unbearable white-hot pain of the grip on his ankle, and it took all his strength and courage to maintain his double grip on the rail. His body was penduluming, as the man who held him was himself swung off the ground and then came back to skid and run in the loose gravel of the embankment as though he were driving a dog sledge. Mark twisted his head back and judged the white blob of the man's face and aimed the kick with his free foot, but it was an impossible target. At that instant the sound of the locomotive altered as it hit the steel of the bridge where it crossed the deep gorge of the river. The uprights of the bridge sprang out of the rushing corridor of blackness. Mark heard the deadly hiss of the riveted steel girders flit past his head, and at the same moment the grip on his leg was released. He clung with his remaining strength and resolve to the railing of that goods truck, while the train racketed over the bridge and ploughed on steadily up the slope, until it burst at last over the crest onto the level ground of the plateau. It picked up speed sharply, and Mark dragged himself inch by agonized inch up the railing, until at last he tumbled over the side of the open boxcar onto the load of sugar sacks, and lay face downwards, sobbing for each breath, while he rode the high storm surf of pain from his leg. The cold roused him at last. His sweat-sodden coat was turned icy by the rush of night air, and he crawled painfully forward towards the shelter of the high steel side of the boxcar. He checked quietly and found with relief that his purse and notebook were still in his pocket. Suddenly he was aware that he was not alone, and fresh panic gripped him. "Who's that?" he croaked, recoiling quickly into a defensive attitude. A voice answered quickly in deep Zulu, "I mean no harm, Nkosi." And Mark felt a quick rush of relief. A man crouched against the side of the car, out of the wind, and it was clear that he was as alarmed by Mark's presence as Mark had been by his. "I mean no harm, Lord," I am a poor man without the money to pay to ride the steamer. My father is sick and dying in Tekwini, Durban. Peace, grunted Mark in the same language. I am a poor man also. He dragged himself into shelter beside the Zulu, and the movement twisted his ankle, and he gasped at the fresh pain. How? The black man's eyes caught the starlight as he peered at Mark. You are hurt. My leg, Mark grunted, trying to ease it into a more comfortable position. And the Zulu leaned forward, and Mark felt his gentle hands on the ankle. You are without shoes? The man was surprised at Mark's torn and bloodied feet. I was chased by bad men. Ha! The Zulu nodded, and Mark saw in the starlight that he was a young man. The leg is bad. I do not think the bone is broken, but it is bad. He untied the small pack beside him and took out some article of clothing. Deliberately, he began to tear the material into strips. No, Mark protested sharply. Do not destroy your clothes for me. He knew how each article of Western clothing, however ragged and threadbare, was treasured. It is an old shirt, said the Zulu simply, and began to bind up the swollen ankle skilfully. When he had finished, it felt easier. Nyabonga, I praise you, Mark told him, and then he shivered violently as the delayed but icy fist of shock clamped down on him. He felt nausea rise in his throat, and he shivered again. The Zulu took the blanket from around his own shoulders and placed it carefully over Mark. No, I cannot take your blanket. The blanket smelled of smoke from a dung fire, and of the Zulu himself, the earthy African tang. I cannot take it. You need it, said the Zulu firmly. You are sick. Very well, Mark muttered, as another shivering fit caught him. But it is a large blanket, big enough for two. It is not fitting. Come, said Mark roughly, and the Zulu hesitated a moment longer before drawing closer and taking up a fold of the woolen blanket. Shoulder to shoulder they sat on into the night, and Mark found himself dropping into a haze of exhaustion and pain, for the swollen ankle still beat like a drum. The Zulu beside him was silent, and Mark thought he slept, but as the train slowed after 2 hours' hard run across the plateau, he whispered quietly, This is Sakabula halt. It stops here for to let the other train pass. Mark remembered the desolate siding with its double loop of line. No buildings and only a signboard to identify it. He would have lapsed once more into half sleep, but something warned him, a strange sense of danger which he had developed so acutely in France. He shrugged aside the blanket and dragged himself up on his knees to peer ahead. The track came into the siding on a gentle curve, and the silver rails glittered in the lamp of the locomotive. Far ahead was the signpost of the halt, stark white in the beam of the locomotive. But there was something else. Parked on the track beside the halt was a dark vehicle, a heavy lorry, and its headlights still burned. In the puddle of yellow light, Mark made out the dark shapes of waiting men. Alarm jarred his bowels and clutched at his chest with a cold, cramping fist. A motor lorry from Ladyburg could not have reached here ahead of them, but a telegraph message could have alerted. I must go, Mark blurted, and with stiff fingers he hooked a sovereign out of his money belt and pressed it quickly into the Zulu's hand. There is no call for... the man began, but Mark cut him off brusquely. Stay in peace. He dragged himself to the side of the car furthest from the waiting men and lowered himself down the steel ladder until he hung just above the tracks. He waited for the locomotive to slow down, groaning and creaking and sighing steam, and then he braced himself and dropped, trying to take most of his weight on his good leg. He collapsed forwards as he struck the ground. Ducking his head, he rolled onto his shoulders and, drawing up his knees, went down the embankment like a rubber ball. In the dry, pale grass beside the line, he did not rise, but dragged himself on elbows and belly to a low, dark thorn bush 50 yards from the rails. Slowly he worked himself under its low, spiny branches and lay face down, gritting his teeth against the dull beat of his ankle. The train had halted with its van level with Mark's hiding place. The guard climbed down, flashing his lantern, while from the head of the train a group of men, each one carrying a lantern, hurried back towards him, searching the open trucks as they came. Mark could see they were all armed, and their voices carried loudly as they called explanations to the driver and fireman who leaned from the cab of the locomotive.
"What's the trouble?"
"You've got a fugitive from justice aboard."
"Who are you?"
"We're special constables."
"Who is the fellow?"
"He's robbed a bank. He killed four men in Ladyburg.
He jumped your train on the escarpment. Don't take any chances, you fellows. The bastard's a killer."
They came swiftly down the train, talking loudly and calling to each other to bolster their courage, and at the last moment Mark remembered the Zulu. He should have warned the man, but he had been too concerned with his own danger. He wanted to shout now, warn him to run, but he could not bring himself to do it. The Zulu would be all right. They would not shoot when they saw he was a black. They might slap him around a little and throw him off. The Zulu darted out from between two of the boxcars, from where he had climbed down onto the coupling. He was a dark, flitting shape, and somebody yelled a warning. Immediately there was a shot. Mark saw the dust from the bullet fly in the lamplight, and the Zulu swerved and ran directly into the open grassland. Half a dozen shots ripped the night. The muzzle flashes were angry red blooms in the night, but the Zulu ran on. One of the men on the track dropped to his knee, and Mark saw his face white and eager in the light of the torches. He aimed deliberately, and his rifle kicked up sharply. The Zulu collapsed in the grass without a cry, and they raced forward in an excited pack to gather around his body.
"Oh, Jesus, it's only a black!"
There was confused, angry discussion and argument for 5 minutes, and then four of them took an arm and leg each and carried the Zulu between them to the parked lorry. The black man's head lolled back, almost sweeping the earth. His mouth gaped open, and the blood that dripped from it was black as tar in the lamplight, and his head swung loosely to the uneven stride of the men who carried him. They lifted him into the back of the lorry. The northbound train came thundering through the siding, its whistle shrilling on a high, piercing shriek, and then it was gone on its way to Ladyburg. The men climbed into the lorry, and the engine fired, and it moved away with its headlights sweeping sky and earth as it pitched over the bumpy track. The stationary train whistled mournfully, and it began to roll forward, rumbling slowly over the tracks. Mark crawled out from his hiding place beneath the bush, and hopped and stumbled after it, catching it just before its speed built up. He crawled over the sugar bags into the lee of the steel side, and found the Zulu had left his blanket. As he wrapped it around his icy body, he felt the guilt flood over him. Guilt for the man's death, the man who had been a friend. Then the guilt turned to anger, bitter, corrosive anger that sustained him through the night as the train rushed southwards. 'Fordsburg is a squalid suburb of Johannesburg, 300 miles from the golden grassy hills of Zululand and the beautiful forested valley of Ladyburg. It is an area of mean cottages, tiny workers' houses of galvanized iron on timber frames, each with a bleak little garden. In some of the gardens there were brave and defiant shows of bright blooms, Barberton daisies, cannas, and flaming red poinsettia, but in most of them the bare, untended earth, patched with blackjack and khaki bush, told of the tenants' indifference. Over the narrow streets and crowded cottages, the mine dumps held majestic sway, towering tabletop mountains of poisonous yellow earth from which the gold had been extracted. The cyanide process of extraction ensured that the earth of the dumps was barren and sterile. No plants grew upon them, and on windy days the yellow dust and grit whipped over the grovelling cottages beneath them. The dumps dominated the landscape, monument to the ant-like endeavours of man, symbols of his eternal greed for gold. The mine headgears were spidery steel structures against the pale, cloudless blue of the high-felt winter sky. The huge steel wheels on their heights spun endlessly back and forth, lowering the cages filled with men deep into the earth, and rising again with the ore bins loaded with the gold-rich rock.